Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome back our speaker for today, Professor Simon Platt, based at College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Georgia. Thank you, Simon. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. First, as usual, just going to check that the sound is okay, and then we can get going. It is? That's great. Okay, so today we're going to focus on monoparesis. So as we'll get into some definitions shortly, obviously this is weakness of one limb, and that presents a problem that we'll try to help with today, and that is whether we're dealing with some type of orthopedic lameness or a neurological dysfunction. Sometimes that is easier to discern than others, so we're going to try and talk about how we do that and also what the most common causes of neurologic monoparesis are. So just a few definitions so we're all on the same page. Some of these are fairly overlapping, but lameness just means that you can't really use your leg very well, so it doesn't imply anything. However, we often use that to infer that you have a non-neurological problem, so more likely a orthopedic issue. But as we can see here, when we look at an overview of all causes of weakness, lameness in one limb, it could be a skeletal problem, could be a muscular problem, could be a joint problem, a vascular problem, or of course could be a neurological problem. Some people will use the term claudication, and claudication essentially means that you have lameness which is often intermittent and presents closely associated with exercise, and you may see pain in the limb muscles, pain proximally, that seemingly referred from a joint. However, most of the time it's coming from the foramen of the spinal column. As you exercise, you increase blood flow. That blood flow that naturally goes through the foramen into the spinal column engorges a vessel and presses on a nerve. And so occasionally we may see exercise-related lameness. Obviously, that could still be orthopedic, joint-related, bone pain-related. However, that might be neurologic. And then when we talk about neurologic lameness, weakness, then we have a possibility of a nerve injury, so a sudden onset abnormality, versus some type of other disease affecting the nerve, versus something in the cord. However, something in the cord often is likely to result in deficits affecting the other limbs as well. We'll get into a little bit of the difference between a lower motor neuron dysfunction and an upper motor neuron dysfunction. But that's what we may see when we have a cord dysfunction. Both lower motor neurons are the affected limb directly over the cord, and an upper motor neuron dysfunction elsewhere. We'll clarify that as we move through. So when we talk about neurologic lameness, dysfunction affecting one leg, if it is not cord related, so nerve root, peripheral nerve related, then we will not see ataxia. So that isn't something that generally helps us. Obviously, that's also the case with orthopedic disease. So if we see ataxia, that gives us some comfort in the differential that it is a neurologic dysfunction. But most of the time, that means the cord has to be affected. We may well see neurogenic atrophy. And neurogenic atrophy is very different from disuse atrophy. Neurogenic atrophy is a manifestation of a lower motor neuron dysfunction, so a dysfunction of the nerve root or peripheral nerve itself. And that occurs within 7 to 10 days of any type of disease or trauma affecting the nerve. And it causes severe muscle atrophy, so severe that you will see bony definition, as we could see here, with the definition of the scapula becoming apparent. Anytime you see such marked muscle atrophy, then this infers that it is neurogenic in origin and therefore a local issue, rather than an orthopedic problem or any problem causing discomfort, which ultimately may result in a disuse atrophy Disuse atrophy is much more moderate to mild in the way it affects the muscle mass, and it takes a long time to become evident. We're talking 2 to 3 months. In addition to neurogenic atrophy, hand in hand with a lower motor neuron problem, we will see reduced reflexes. And those reflexes will be isolated to the limb that is affected. And those reflexes will be both extensor and flexor. So easiest to perform a flexor reflex, where we have a noxious stimulation of the digits and we look for flexion of all of the joints, leading to a withdrawal of the limb. Monoparesis or monoplegia, so this means that when we have this weakness, it either it leaves us still with some motor function, so that's monoparesis, or there is absolutely no motor function left, and that is monoplegia. That usually helps us discern a neurologic from an orthopedic issue. However, we have seen some cases of very acute onset cruciate disorders, leading to a very weak limb where movement is almost impossible to see. Intermittent versus constant abnormalities, these can help as well. Most of the time, if you have a neurologic problem, it's constant, because the trauma that's affected the nerve doesn't disappear immediately, because any other cause of neurologic dysfunction, such as a lateralized disc or infection, inflammation or tumor, doesn't go away as well. Intermittent is more likely to be a orthopedic issue, however not 100% of the time, because of the issue, at least of what we've just said, of claudication. Weight bearing or not doesn't help us too much. Most of the time we say there's usually a parallel between the amount of motor function that's present and the amount of weight bearing that is possible. That, as you'll see in one of our videos shortly, that isn't always the case. You could have quite a lot of motor function left but not be weight bearing, and that could be due to nerve root pain, or it could be related to increased flexor function once your extensors are taken out. And again, that will be something that we'll describe in a video shortly. Pain or not, again, difficult to say that separates orthopedic disease from neurologic. Many neurologic diseases may not be painful, there are a few that are. So nerve root irritation is very painful. Tumors of the nerve and nerve root are also quite painful. So difficult to use pain to help us out, but it is an important piece of the jigsaw. And then obviously, while we're looking at trying to discern are you neurologic based on these issues, we also have to rule out bone or joint or muscle diseases. Most of the time, that's going to involve obviously a thorough orthopedic examination, as well as radiographic, potentially CT evaluations as well. And as we'll talk about the potential for muscle diseases, we can look at blood tests. We can look at EMGs and potentially muscle biopsies. So what conditions do we think that could affect the nervous system and just result in one limb being abnormal? So we go through our usual vitamin D mnemonic, with each of these things telling us a group of diseases or a single type of disease that can help us out. So we start with V for vascular. We have aortic thromboembolism, or fibrocartilaginous embolism. Fibrocartilaginous embolism, or embolic myelopathy, is often called FCE or FCEM, and that's something that affects the spinal cord. It can certainly cause monoparesis. It can be very asymmetric. There is usually some evidence of another limb being affected because it is cord dysfunction, but not always. This is a per acute onset of dysfunction and can be upper or lower motor neuron in character based on where the vascular event has hit. As we'll see, we'll describe where the lower motor neurons come out, but essentially in the base of the neck or the base of the thoracolumbar spine, we're going to get lower motor neuron dysfunction. And as we said, that results in not only weakness, but neurogenic atrophy and loss of reflex function. Aortic thromboembolism is something that we know a lot about in cats, but has recently been described in dogs as well. So we're going to talk about that toward the end of this session. Infectious and inflammatory diseases, Toxoplasma neosporis, or protozoal disease is something that can take out nerve roots, potentially just one limb, but maybe both pelvic limbs, both thoracic limbs, or even all four limbs. Discospondylitis, inflammation of the disc spaces, it's usually a bacterial infection, occasionally fungal. That can be something that causes nerve root entrapment and can result again in monoparesis, but usually presents with back pain and involvement of more than just one limb. Trauma, this should hopefully come with some history to help us out. Not always. We have to try to discern this from the potential activity of the dog. Nerve injury can occur, leaving us with a temporary weakness, but avulsion can also occur, which will lead us with a permanent issue, and we'll talk about that later in the session. Toxin, it's unlikely that toxin will just affect one limb. Botulism is an example of a toxin that will affect nerve function, leading to weakness and reduced reflexes. But it isn't something usually that will take out one limb. So we put that in parentheses or brackets here. N for neoplasia. Okay, so this is something that can affect one limb. You can get nerve sheath tumors or meningiomas affecting nerves that will reduce the function of that nerve and therefore the leg. And so we'll talk about that. Lymphoma is always a possibility, particularly if you have something affecting multiple nerves. If you're going to consider a neoplasia, really it's the only one that's likely. And then D for degeneration, well, a lateralized disc herniation is always possible, as is foraminal stenosis. Foraminal stenosis being some osseous proliferation relating to degeneration in the spinal column, or even secondary to instability, micro-instability related to disc herniation. So let's go over a little bit more of the clinical signs of nerve disease to make this clearer before we get into what we do about it diagnostically and the specific conditions that can affect the nerves. So obviously we're talking about monoparesis, depending on how many nerves are involved. And if the cord's involved, occasionally it can lead to paraparesis or tetraparesis. Tetraparesis is usually where we'll start to say we have a neuromuscular dysfunction. So usually a peripheral neuropathy, a neuromuscular junction problem like myasthenia gravis, or a generalized myopathy. These are all things which could affect just one limb, especially at the outset of the condition, but most of the time lead quickly to an involvement of all four limbs. Paraparesis, this is something that could affect nerve, that could be due to nerve root problems in both, affecting both pelvic limbs. And again, maybe one worse than another. And obviously, we're talking about monoparesis just due to nerves. So classically, we'll see dogs with both pelvic limbs affected by a neurologic dysfunction due to cord disease. Classically, tetraparesis due to peripheral neuropathies and muscle disease. But both of these things can be due to a more diffuse nerve root disease. And so it's just something to keep an eye out for. Monoparesis, though, is what we're talking about today, in obvious lameness or dysfunction of one limb, as we can see here in these two dogs. If we're talking about a neurologic dysfunction, as we've said, and it's worth repeating, The two things you are going to look for are decreased reflexes, extensor and flexor, the flexor being pinch the digits and look for full flexion involving all the joints if that's physically possible. And extensor reflexes, those are the ones that we use with the hammer, or we test with the hammer rather, in specific points. And these can be difficult, especially in small dogs, to perform even when normal. We are looking for an extensor response when we strike the muscle belly or the tendon associated with that muscle, and that can be subjective in its interpretation. Most of the time we're going to rely more heavily on the flexor reflexes. Obviously, regarding the extensor reflex, the most commonly performed one that we feel most comfortable with is going to be the patellar tendon reflex, femoral nerve, and that's something we will mention a little bit as we move through this talk. So we've got decreased reflexes, and we've got early and severe muscle atrophy. Again, this is neurogenic atrophy. So these are the two things that will help us say for sure we have a reduced nerve function affecting that limb. However, this is not as easy as it sounds sometimes. If you have an acute lesion, then you're not going to have muscle atrophy just yet. And you might have a very painful animal, which means it's difficult to perform these flexor withdrawal reflexes. So particularly following trauma, it may be very difficult to know exactly what's going on. We may have conscious proprioception deficits in some animals. These can be subjective too. We evaluate these with postural reactions, where we support the weight of the animal and we turn the digits over, and we're seeing if we've got a corrective response where the digits will come back to place. A little bit further down the line of sensory dysfunction, we may see loss of superficial sensation, almost an anesthesia affecting certain areas of the skin, and we'll see maps of this shortly. And this can help us, however, it does rely on a behavioral response. It's easy in you and I for us to be tested when a doctor will pinch an area of skin or stimulate an area of skin and ask you if you feel it. However, for a dog to respond to that, the stimulation usually needs to be a little bit more aggressive, and we're relying on a behavioral response more than anything else, and that can mean that we have a subjective test. Loss of deep pain is the most severe dysfunction that will accompany nerve disease, and this often implies a very poor prognosis. When we're unsure of the origin of particularly an acute dysfunction, then it is very important that we test deep pain. So if you're presented with an animal and you think that it's traumatic, for instance, and you can't really evaluate the limb because you're not quite sure if there is a structural defect, a fracture, for instance, and you therefore can't really do reflexes and there's no muscle atrophy, the one prognostic thing that we'll always do will be to pinch the digits and look for a behavioral response. Loss of a pain response following a very aggressive stimulation of the digits is a very poor prognostic indicator. So let's look at front and back limbs, or thoracic and pelvic limbs, and talk about some more specific dysfunctions. There are obviously a lot of nerves present in each limb, but the main ones are worth highlighting. So when we're talking about the thoracic limb here, we're talking about the caudal aspect of the cervical cord, so C6 to T2 segments. These nerves are the nerves that come out of those segments, and the ones that are most likely to give us a monoparesis are radial, median, and ulnar. Most of the time it's a radial and ulnar thing that we'll see, radial being the main extensor nerve and ulnar being your main flexor nerve. So these are what we're really looking for. Bear in mind, when we talk about limb dysfunction and nerves, to avoid it getting overcomplicated, the main thing that each limb will do will be to extend and flex. And so there is always going to be one main extensor nerve in the front limb, it's radial, and one main flexor nerve, and that will be our ulna. So coming out of the spinal cord, again, this is not to make it overcomplicated, just to give an idea of what we're talking about. Here we have the sections of the cervical spinal cord, and yes, there are eight cervical spinal cord segments, even though there are only seven vertebrae. And then it moves into the cranial thoracic cord. And each one of these gives rise to nerve roots, which will contribute to slightly different combination, resulting in a peripheral nerve. So, as an example, we may have a C7 nerve root here coming out, and a C6 and a C8 leading, those three leading into one peripheral nerve. So you might lose a nerve root here, but yet your peripheral nerve is still being fed. And so when we lose a complete peripheral nerve, we know we've got more extensive damage here. And obviously, as you know, multiple nerves here lead into a plexus, and in the front limb, that's the brachial plexus. So the most important nerve for us in the thoracic limb is the extensor nerve, and that's the radial. And we can see this being involved in traumatic injuries because it runs close to the first rib and over the humerus. Its main function is that it extends the elbow, so supporting weight, and also extends the carpus and digits. This nerve extends limbs, bears weight, so extremely important. You can still bear weight if you damage this nerve if you just have an injury below the elbow being extremely important for bearing weight. It won't be normal weight bearing, but it will be possible. Anything above the elbow, and this is going to lead to an animal that does not bear weight. So here we can see a cat presenting with monoparesis, and you can see now we've got flexion of the elbow, flexion of the carpus, starting to see some muscle mass loss here. So in these cases, then we have a more classic presentation of radial nerve dysfunction. Again, this helps show a little bit of muscle mass atrophy, muscle mass loss here, being that we've got neurogenic atrophy, pronounced muscle loss very quickly, says we have nerve root damage. Another picture of an animal affected classically with radial nerve damage, so more of a dropped elbow because of the flexion and flexed carpus here. And so this says more radial nerve damage. Doesn't tell us the cause, doesn't tell us the prognosis. As long as he's got pain sensation present in these digits, then we're likely to have an okay prognosis, but then becomes more dependent on the underlying disease. Here's our first video, and this shows actually a bilateral radial nerve problem in a cat, and we can see that they're dropped elbows and the flexed carpus. So pelvic limbs are actually normal, and in this cat, the difficulty moving the limb, slight asymmetry with the right limb being better than the left. Postural reactions are absent in the thoracic limbs. Difficult to evaluate because this is a cat, so this is real life, but we've not got much in the way of a hop going on. Trying to evaluate the pelvic limbs, and then the cat will try to replace these limbs pretty quickly, so it seems like that is acceptable. We'll call those normal. But you can see the posture in the front limb suggests that this is abnormal. And when we look at reflexes, always difficult to perform in a cat, you can do flexor withdrawal, so we're pinching the digits, and we can do patella tendon, femoral reflex here, and see a good kick out here in both pelvic limbs. But then when we look to evaluate the thoracic limbs for flexor withdrawal, we don't have as good a response. Take your life in your own hands a little bit. Here, very poor response. Okay, So that's bilateral thoracic limb involvement. And in that case, because of the reduced reflexes, that has to be neurologic. And because of the posture that we're seeing here, that's suggestive of bilateral radial. When we talk about then the pelvic limbs, we're talking about the caudal thoracolumbar, lumbar sacral spinal cord, so L4 to S2. And we've got, again, a selection of nerves that arise from that area of the spinal cord. Most important for us, again, the nerve that extends, that's the femoral nerve that comes out of L4, L5, and the nerve that flexes, and that's the sciatic nerve. Here, the sciatic nerve turns into two nerves that have more distal function, peroneal and tibial. And so here we can see that we have the sciatic nerve coming down, and there's a cranial nerve and a caudal nerve. The cranial nerve is going to be the peroneal, and the caudal nerve is going to be the tibial. So at the level of the stifle, it kind of splits off into two main segments. And again, like we showed for the thoracic limb, we can see this lumbar segmentation here, L4, L5. And so these two segments are going to predominantly give rise to a femoral nerve. And then we have L6, L7, and then the sacral nerves here now, as well as the nerves to the pelvic limb. Remember that the sacral segments give rise to the pelvic and the pudendal nerves, which are going to control sphincter tone, both urethral and anal, and also bladder function, so detrusor muscle. And then caudal to that, we have the caudal nerves, what used to be called coccygeal nerves, and these will innervate the tail. So sometimes we'll see an animal with a pelvic limb dysfunction due to involvement of one or several of these nerve roots. It will also have bladder, bowel dysfunction, maybe tail dysfunction as well. So we mentioned that sometimes your weight-bearing ability is in parallel with your muscle function or your voluntary movement function. Sometimes that doesn't quite add up. Here is a dog with what seems to be exhibiting hyperflexion of this pelvic limb. And this is a dog that actually has a femoral nerve problem. Femoral nerve is important for extension, so weight bearing. If you knock that out, then your flexor nerves will predominate. And so they can lead to a more flexed posture of the limb, but definitely very poor weight bearing. You can see we've got a dog essentially hopping on his back leg, not just toe touching. And this could easily be an orthopedic issue. And we'll see as we evaluate the dog that it becomes more evident that it's neurologic. So we're doing postural reactions in the front limbs just to be complete and make sure that we don't have anything going on in those limbs. In the right back limb, we can see that we've got normal postural reaction. And in the left pelvic limb, we've got absence. So suggestive that it's neurologic, not confirmatory based on any presence of pain. You can see that we don't have much motor function. Dog's a little painful there on flexing that limb. Now we do the reflexes. When we do flexor withdrawal, this dog pulls back well in that thoracic limb. In the pelvic limb, we check physically to make sure that the dog can flex all the joints. Bones and joints are okay on palpation. So we see that there's a slight reduced tone in this limb. We go for the patellar reflex and we get nothing. And compare it to the other side, tremendous response there. And on this side, nothing. So suggestive of a femoral nerve problem here. And we pinch, and the dog can flex that limb back. It's not great, but a lot of this is difficult to interpret because of the amount of pain that we have. Now what we're doing is checking for deep pain. Now if we notice, and we'll see a picture shortly to help us with this, pinching immediately here, as we'll see when we reinstate the video, will give us minimal response. Pinching laterally will give us a significant response. So immediately, we haven't got much response there laterally, we get a big response. So it's important when you check the digits to check median or lateral. And the reason for that in this case is that the femoral nerve supplies the more medial aspect of the limb, and the lateral digits are supplied by the sciatic. Okay, if you have sciatic damage, it's possible that as we said, you could have just or a predominance of peroneal nerve versus a tibial nerve injury. Peroneal nerve, this is in, this injury causes overextension of the hock and overflexion of the digits. So most of the time, this is an animal that stands straight with it, with his digits turned over, knuckled. And you can sort of appreciate it in this pelvic limb. It's not a very common injury on its own. It implies a more distal injury, so at the level or below the stifle. This is maybe a little bit easier to see. This dog here has a quite straight limb extended with flexion of the digits, so this would be more likely peroneal nerve injury. And we'll show this video just shortly. We won't do the full thing, just to show you the gait that we've got here, because this is a monoplegia. So you have a little bit of proximal movement maybe, but really no movement in the limb that seems voluntary. Tail hanging down as well, that's important. The right pelvic limb looks good. So significant deficit here. This is monoplegia. You might say maybe there's a little bit of movement there. And what's going to be most important is, can this dog feel pain when you stimulate the digits? We turn these digits over. This is our proprioception test. And this dog has nothing there. So we think you could be neurologic as long as we're supporting the weight. That tells us that's what's going on. Turn the digits over on the other side and we get a fairly rapid response. So at this stage, we have an indication of a significant asymmetric deficit affecting the pelvic limb on the left side, and likely this is neurologic based on the postural reaction, but what we're going to look for is a reflex deficit and potentially a muscle tone mass lesion, but it may be just slightly too early for that in this case. So that's more of a peroneal lesion. Tibial lesions, these are injuries which, or diseases, usually injuries, which cause dropped hocks or tarsuses, tarsi, and overflexion of the hock causing that, with overextension of the digits. So this is probably a more common scenario. And we'll just see that we'll have a dropped hock and overflexion here. This just looks like a cat sitting down, to be honest, but that's what you're going to end up with, a very plantigrade stance. These two things can also be evident in combination, particularly if you have sciatic injury. When we're talking, as we talked about before, about pinching in specific areas, the limbs are mapped out quite well with their innervation zones or cutaneous zones. So each area of the limb is innervated by a specific nerve. And when we're talking about the front limb, you can see here that we've got the radial nerve coming down here, lateral, cranial, lateral, and then over the digits here, and the medial digit. And then on the lateral aspect, the back and the lateral aspect of the limbs, that lateral digit is your ulnar nerve. So those are the two main things here. In the pelvic limb, we've essentially got sciatic split into what is peroneal nerve here, that's the majority of it, and then we've got a little bit of tibial nerve, this orange thing here, and the green here, that's your medial, and that's your saphenous branch of the femoral nerve. So medial is more femoral, and then lateral is more peroneal tibial. So if we think we have a neurologic problem affecting a limb based on the possible causes and locations, then we have to come up with some tests which will help us move through these. And these are the array of tests that we have to consider for various reasons. So we must consider a minimum database because, as we said on the list, we may actually have a neoplasia involved or an infectious inflammatory disease involved. So we would like to see if it's somewhere else. The minimum database could also include evidence of muscle dysfunction by looking at the levels of AST and CK or creatinine kinase. Those muscle enzymes may help us see if we have local inflammation, although they're not specific for just muscle, and they are not really helpful in telling us whether it's primary or secondary muscle disease, because recumbency or trauma to that muscle can cause elevations of those enzymes. Thoracic and abdominal radiographs are helpful when we look to see whether we have evidence of inflammatory or neoplastic disease. Spinal radiographs are also helpful, ruling out discus spondylitis, potentially trauma, sometimes lysis due to neoplasia. Myelography will help discern whether you have a disease that is compressing the nervous tissue that is not seen on the radiographs. However, it's more common these days to have CT and MRI help, and we'll talk a little bit more about those as we move through. Electrodiagnostics, we'll mention this briefly now, but electrodiagnostics are a group of tests that help us look at nerve and muscle function, and sometimes these tests can really be very helpful telling us that we have a nerve disease versus a orthopedic disease. So we look at usually electromyography. This is needle electromyography. It tells us about the stability of muscles. We'll mention this in a second. We can also see the velocity with which the nerves conduct at. The nerve roots can be assessed by cord dorsum potentials and F waves. These are usually then more academic tests and not widely available. However, it's worth mentioning the needle electromyography test, which we'll show you now as a video, because this can help sometimes when you're not sure if you have orthopedic disease or muscle disease. Electromyography is where an animal is under anesthesia and you put a needle into specific muscle bellies, and it shows a spontaneous electrical activity which you would not have if an animal is under anesthesia and is normal. These activity are called fibrillations and positive sharp waves, and you'll hear these as well as see these, and they, just like the atrophy, it's neurogenic, turn up after about 7 to 10 days. So when we look for these on a screen, you'll just see, instead of a flat line, which is what is normal muscle in normal animals under anesthesia, we'll see abnormal electricity. Here we can see again abnormal electricity, just little deviations from the baseline, and then here we have these are actually called positive sharp waves, and these little guys are called fibrillations. But easier to detect is actually the change in sound that we see with these. So if we play this video, you can hear that there's sound accompanying the abnormality, and the sound has been compared to frying eggs or rain on a roof, rustling paper, multiple types of sound comparisons, and so you can make your own decision here. I can't seem to get this video to play. Hopefully. So you can hear this if you want to see it on the screen. So that tells us that we definitely have nerve or muscle damage. It doesn't tell you what the cause is. It's been there at least a week, and it's in those muscles of that limb. So it's specific to the location, and it's very sensitive, but it's not specific to the type of disease. So that is something that can help you. discern whether you have an orthopedic problem or a neurologic problem, because you will not see that with orthopedic disease. So let's get on to some specific causes then. Obviously, trauma is a major consideration when we're dealing with monoparesis that might be neurological, and obviously that's something that will come on quite quickly. The peripheral nerve injury actually can be classed in three ways. We can have a neuropraxia, which is essentially a dead arm or a dead leg, where the nerve is shocked or bruised by the trauma but is structurally intact. Axonotomesis is where the myelin sheath is still intact but the axons inside it are damaged, potentially severed. And so this outer scaffolding is intact and can lead to reasonable healing depending on where proximally or distally the nerve injury is. Neurotomesis is a complete severing of the nerve. The problem is all of these classifications in the early days can look exactly the same, a limb that doesn't work. And so you may have something that takes a little while to get better, days to sometimes weeks, versus something that will never get better without surgical correction, and even then carries a guarded prognosis, presenting in the same way. Here's an example of a dog being hit by a car, presenting with monoparesis, and this was due to brachial plexus avulsion. You can see that there's a little bit of movement there, which is good news. Very asymmetric, that left limb is great. And you can see that there's a slight dropped elbow and a flexion there of the digits. This looks like a radial nerve damage. And then we check the back limbs. The back limbs look good, and so this is a very peripheral problem here. So this tells us peripheral neurologic based on the posture of that limb most likely and the failure of hopping, but we would then need to look at muscle atrophy, and there probably won't be any if this is the first day, and then we need to look at reflex function. Surgery is probably the only proactive treatment that we can do for this, and this is limited to certain cases in certain institutions, because unfortunately you have to find where the nerve would be severed or transplant a nerve, not something that's commonly done in veterinary medicine, and the prognosis is always going to remain guarded. Should you have an iatrogenic damage of a nerve, so performing a surgery and a nerve gets severed, then immediately suturing it back together may help. You will have death of the distal segment, but the proximal segment can grow and re-innovate using that distal segment as a scaffold. Physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, so adjunctive treatments to try to support the muscle mass and the blood flow and lymph drainage locally, are essential to try to encourage regeneration. The nerves will grow back slowly, and they may not reinnervate the appropriate muscles, but they will grow back, so you need to keep the rest of the animal doing well, and that is maintaining good muscle mass, good blood flow, good lymph drainage, good mental state. Splints will help aid extension of the joints, albeit temporary, so you don't get contractures. Perfective footwear will stop them from dragging their digits and causing excoriations. Skin care as well. Sometimes these dogs will get a pins and needles type pain, that's what we believe, and they'll start to lick or bite at their toes and digits as they heal or with loss of sensations. And those are things which medications may help with pain relief, straightforward pain relief, or neuropathic discomfort medications. So gabapentin is one of the classic things that can help at 10 mg per kg 3 times a day. Prognosis ultimately depends on the severity of the injury and how long it's been going on, and there's no guarantee that you're going to get return of function. So that's trauma, inflammation. This is often more chronic and progressive. It can just be one limb, but also can be two. And those are usually back limbs or front limbs, as we can see in this dog here. Rather like the cat, the pelvic limbs were okay. The thoracic limbs are affected. And so again, we believe that with just thoracic limbs affected, that if it's a neurologic problem, it could well be brachial plexus bilaterally or bilateral nerve roots. You can see the weakness that's evident in these limbs. There was a little bit of muscle atrophy evident at this time as well, and the reflexes are quite poor. And so, indicative of a nerve disease, and this dog actually had a bilateral brachial plexus neuritis, which is an immune-mediated disease. Pelvic limbs are normal in this dog. When we look at causes of inflammation, so if we consider it could be inflammation, really we're talking about infection, and that is protozoal, so toxo or neospora, versus immune-mediated. And that's possibly brachial plexus neuritis if that's where it's located, but it could just be one nerve root as well. So we do see immune mediated. What the inciting antigen is, cause of the immune mediated, at this stage we don't know. Some people suggest diet is a possibility. Some people suggest that vaccination is a possibility, but nothing really proven. So we look for some antigenic stimulation and very infrequently get anything that is suggestive of a cause. We have to rule out trauma, obviously, but the history of a more chronic progressive condition can help us with that. CSF tap can help because locally there may be inflammation, and titers to look for infectious disease. Obviously, as we said, dietary history if you're looking for an antigenic stimulation. Bone marrow, aspirate, lymph node aspirate if you're thinking that potentially this is something like lymphoma, and EMG and nerve biopsy. Be a bit more invasive, but it's a specific way to help us out, see that we have infectious disease. Treatment, if you think you have protozoal disease, you're really looking at clindamycin and trimethoprim drugs as a combination. And if you are looking for an immune-mediated disease, you're going to need immunosuppressives, and this could be a lifelong thing. But it could also just be a 2 to 3 month course of tapering immunosuppressive dose if you're thinking about prednisone. Now, obviously, there are more immunomodulating drugs out there on the market which we're more comfortable using, such as cyclosporine, such as mycophenolate, cytosine, and even azathioprine. Tumor is a possibility, and this can either be lymphoma in diffuse cases or nerve sheath tumors and even meningiomas in focal cases. These again are chronic and progressive and often present with some persistent pain on palpation. In the front limbs, that may be palpation up in the axilla, or even just on extension flexion of the limb. Yeah, this is a common, peripheral nerve tumors are common tumors affecting the nervous system, about a quarter of them, essentially. A quarter of all tumors are peripheral nerve sheath tumors. And they affect older dogs mainly, not common in cats. In most common, they affect the thoracic limbs, but can certainly affect pelvic limbs. Most of the time, we'll call these peripheral nerve sheath tumors. In people, these are further classified as neurofibromas, neurofibrosarcomas, neurolemomas, and so multiple different types, which we don't do in veterinary medicine. This is an example of a radial nerve sheath tumor dog. This is a 9-year-old Shepherd mix that came in. This here is with a chronic progressive head bobbing lameness, so could well be orthopedic. Had pain up on palpation of the axilla, pain on flexion because it was radial nerve sheath tumor. There was poor weight bearing, but still present at this stage, and a reduced reflex in that limb. No history of trauma, and at this stage of presentation, although not that evident on this video, there was muscle atrophy as well. So you can actually feel a mass in about a third of these cases that are spreading down into the brachial plexus if it's in the thoracic limbs. EMG is very sensitive but not specific. So we'll tell you you've got nerve damage here, but it's not, particularly in a case like you've just seen in that video where you think, well, that could be an orthopedic lameness. EMG will really help you say, no, that's nerve damage, but doesn't tell you it's a tumor versus infection versus trauma. Ultrasound, if it's a distal tumor, can actually help you and show a large hypoechoic structure lacking blood flow. Fine needle aspirate, if you can palpate a mass, can help. But unfortunately, these peripheral nerve sheath tumors do not exfoliate very well, so you might not get anything back. CT can help show an enhancing mass in most of the time, contrast enhancing mass. And often ring enhancing. And you may be able to identify if there's any thoracic involvement. But MRI is the best way to go because rather than with CT showing that you've got, if it's in the nerve root coming out of the foramen, that you've got atrophy of the bone due to pressure necrosis here, then on MRI, you'll have a more evident diffuse thickening or even a nodule that's present, as you can see here. That's often hyper intense or bright on T2 and iso intense or at least having some signal on T1 images. So MRI helps show the soft tissue involvement, the extent of the lesion, the size of the lesion. So it would be important for us to discern so that we know what surgery we would be looking at if we're going to treat these. Remembering that what we see is not the true extent of the disease because there will be microscopic extension of it. Surgical resection is the best treatment at this stage described for peripheral nerve sheath tumors, and the success really depends on where they're located. It could either be in the nerve roots or around the foramen close to the cord, it could be in the plexus, or it could be in the peripheral nerve itself. And peripheral tumors probably intuitively carry the best prognosis. The more distal you are, the more likely that surgery would be a cure. You have to be aware that even when we see an obvious thickening of the nerve on MRI, so here's the spinal cord, end on, transverse section, and we have the nerve root coming down through the foramen, very thickened compared to the other side here, that this most likely is a nerve sheath tumor. But in some cases, a less evident swelling or thickening could actually be inflammatory disease or trauma, and so resection of the nerve and maybe amputation is not warranted. Plexus tumors have a median relapse-free time of 7.5 months, can be quite extensive, and their median survival time is a year. So with amputation and resection. And the nerve root tumors, these are the worst. They could relapse quite quickly within a month and have a 5 month median survival time. So the closer you are to the spinal cord, the worse your prognosis. If you have pelvic limb involvement as well, ipsilaterally, then the chances are that you're already in the cord, regardless of what your MRI says. And that again implies a poorer prognosis. These things are not very radiation responsive from the limited studies that are available. And vascular disease will end with this. Commonly we're aware of this in cats where this is aortic thromboembolism, a very acute onset of vascular occlusion. And this leads to muscle and nerve related damage that is ischemic, can cause pain and swelling in the muscles and reduce nervous system function. Obviously, we check the pulses in these cases and look for cyanotic nail beds as well. Could be very asymmetric or could be bilateral. In cats, obviously, we think of a left atrial enlargement, cardiomyopathy, hyperthyroidism, pulmonary neoplasia, and occasionally supravalvular microstenosis can be the cause of these. And these really, there's nothing that we are able to do. We let nature take a course. People have talked about surgery and thrombolytics, no major evidence that makes a difference at this stage. Physiotherapy. Adjunctive care is the best way to go, and then addressing the primary inciting event is really what's going to be most important. And unfortunately, that leads to a poor overall prognosis, regardless of limb recovery. In dogs, however, this is a more of a silent condition and should be kept on your radar for a potential of a disease that causes a lameness or even bilateral weakness. 50% of dogs with this disease will have a chronic presentation and maybe a waxing, waning, or intermittent disease. They'll present with exercise intolerance, and the inciting causes here are excessive or chronic steroid use, or Cushing's, and potentially neoplasia. So basically, in a dog presenting with monoparesis of the pelvic limbs or bilateral weakness, particularly if it's exercise associated, always feel the pulses because that will help you say that you have a suggestion of the disease that's vascular occlusion in origin. So in summary, neurologic causes of lameness can occur, causing just one or several limbs to be involved, and they may sometimes occur at the same time as an orthopedic problem complicating your workup. Onset and progression of the disease may help you define is this trauma, vascular, versus neoplasia or inflammatory. And the main clinical indicators of a nervous system problem are going to be neurogenic atrophy occurring after about 7 days and the loss of reflexes, particularly flexor jaw reflexes. Right, thank you very much for your attention. I'm happy to address any questions. We have a couple of these. First question is, how quickly do nerves grow back and what time for recovery should we give patients with nerve disease? Okay, it's a good question. The nerves will grow back at about 2 millimeters a day. And so that's a fairly rapid growth, but they need a target. And most of the time they'll that target is they are guided to by a structure. And so if they've got severed nerves, there's no structure guiding them, there's no scaffolding, and so the nerves will grow in a haphazard manner. If the myelin sheath is still intact or you suture the nerve back together, then they can use that as a scaffolding to grow distally. So 2 to 3 millimeters a day helps you. If it isn't a severance of nerve and the nerve doesn't need to grow, then recovery time can take up to 3 months for us to see as a maximal. So if we're dealing with a brachial plexus avulsion, for instance, then we will often give that patient a good 3 months to show us the extent of its recovery before we will say that no further recovery is possible. Now, if you have lost deep pain, then we need that to return within 7 days, or we will not really likely have a full recovery present. So in the presence of deep pain, we will give these dogs a good 3 months to heal. If there's been no improvement at all in the first month, it's unlikely you're going to see some by 3 months, but because we need to see a slow and steady progression of healing. But that's what we will usually give before we'll make any drastic decisions. The second question is, do you frequently test for superficial pain? Well, this is something that's tested in people with a lot more success than dogs. In dogs, superficial pain, where we just pinch the skin rather than the periosteum, where we're testing deep pain, is something that requires a easily discernible behavioral response, as we said when we talked about the mapping out of the limbs. And unfortunately, some dogs will not respond very well in a repeatable or robust manner, so we end up not being certain of the response indicating nerve damage, and we're not really sure how this indicates a difference in prognosis. So we might test for it, but the utility of it is somewhat debatable. Deep pain, however, where we stimulate the periosteum of the digits, for instance, we're checking there for the most severe of damage, and if that's not present, regardless of the origin, whether this is due to vascular disease or whether it's due to lateralized disc disease or brachial plexus avulsion, regardless of the origin, the prognosis is very poor. And as we said with the first question, we need to see pain come back within 7 days for us to actually be happy that there's a chance of recovery. Okay, well, if there's any further questions, feel free to post these to me. Otherwise, thank you very much for your attention, and I will say goodbye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Simon for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.